small child in the nursery. And I recall waking the next morning too, opening my eyes to see shafts of wintry sunlight playing upon the sloping white ceiling, and the delightful feeling of ease and refreshment in mind and limbs. Perhaps I recall those sensations the more vividly because of the contrast that presented with what was to come after. Had I known that my untroubled night of good sleep was to be the last such that I was to enjoy for so many terrifying, racked, and weary nights to come, perhaps I should not have jumped out of bed with such alacrity, eager to be down and have breakfast, and then to go out and begin the day. Indeed, even now in later life, though I have been as happy and at peace in my home at Monk's Peace, and with my dear wife Esme, as any man may hope to be, and even though I thank God every night that it is all over, all long past, and will not, cannot come again, yet I do not believe I have ever again slept so well as I did that night in the inn at Crithin Gifford. For I see that then I was still all in a state of innocence. But that innocence, once lost, is lost for ever. The bright sunshine that filled my room when I drew back the flowered curtains was no fleeting early morning visitor. By contrast with the fog of London and the wind and rain of the previous evening's journey up here, the weather was quite altered, as Mr. Daly had confidently predicted that it would be. Although it was early November, and this a cold corner of England, when I stepped out of the Gifford Arms after enjoying a remarkably good breakfast, the air was fresh, crisp and clear, and the sky as blue as a blackbird's egg. The little town was built, for the most part, of stone and rather austere grey slate, and set low, the houses huddled together and looking in on themselves. I wandered about, discovering the pattern of the place. A number of straight, narrow streets or lanes led off at every angle from the compact market square, in which the hotel was situated, and which was now filling up with pens and stalls, carts, wagons and trailers, in preparation for the market. From all sides came the cries of men to one another, as they worked, hammering temporary fencing, hauling up canvas awnings over stalls, wheeling barrows over the cobbles. It was as cheerful and purposeful a sight as I could have found to enjoy anywhere, and I walked about with a great appetite for it all. But when I turned my back on the square, and went up one of the lanes, at once all the sounds were deadened, so that all I heard were my own footsteps in front of the quiet houses. There was not the slightest rise or slope on the ground anywhere. Crithin Gifford was utterly flat, but coming suddenly to the end of one of the narrow streets, I found myself at once in open country, and saw field after field stretching away into the pale horizon. I saw then what Mr. Daly had meant about the town tucking itself in with its back to the wind, for indeed all that could be seen of it from here were the backs of houses and shops, and of the main public buildings in the square. There was a touch of warmth in the autumn sunshine, and what few trees I saw, all bent a little away from the prevailing wind, still had a few last russet and golden leaves clinging to the ends of their branches. But I imagined how drear and grey and bleak the place would be in the dank rain and mist, how beaten and battered at for days on end by those gales that came sweeping across the flat, open country, how completely cut off by blizzards. That morning I had looked again at Crithin Gifford on the map. To north, south and west, there was rural emptiness for many miles. It was 12 to Homerby, the next place of any size, 30 to a large town, to the south, and about 7 to any other village at all. To the east there were only marshes, the estuary, and then the sea. For anything other than a day or two it would certainly not do for me, but as I strolled back towards the market I felt very much at home and content in the place, refreshed by the brightness of the day and fascinated by everything I saw. When I reached the hotel again, I found that a note had been left for me in my absence by Mr. Jerome, the agent who dealt with such property and land business as Mrs. Drablow had conducted, and who was to be my companion at the funeral. In a polite, formal hand, he suggested that he return at 10:40 to conduct me to the church, and so for the rest of the time until then, I sat in the front window of the parlour at the Gifford Arms, reading the daily newspapers and watching the preparations in the marketplace. Within the hotel, too, there was a good deal of activity, which I took to be in connection with the auction sale. From the kitchen area, as doors occasionally swung open, wafted the rich smells of cooking, of roasting meat and baking bread, of pies and pastry and cakes. And from the dining room came the clatter of crockery. By 10:15, the pavement outside began to be crowded with solid, prosperous-looking farmers in tweed suits, calling out greetings, shaking hands, nodding vigorously in discussion. I was sad to be obliged to leave it all, dressed in my dark, formal suit and overcoat, with black armband and tie and a black hat in my hand, when Mr. Jerome arrived. There was no mistaking him because of the similar drabness of his outfit. And we shook hands and went out onto the street. For a moment, standing there looking over the colourful, busy scene upon us, I felt like a spectre at some cheerful feast, and that our appearance among the men in workaday or country clothes was that of a pair of gloomy ravens. And indeed that was the effect we seemed to have at once upon everyone who saw us. As we passed through the square, we were the focus of uneasy glances. Men drew back from us slightly, and fell silent and stiff, in the middle of their conversations, so that I began to be unhappy, feeling like some pariah, and glad to get away and into one of the quiet streets that led, Mr. Jerome indicated, directly to the parish church. He was a particularly small man, only 5 feet 2 or 3 inches tall at most, and with an extraordinary domed head, fringed round at the very back with ginger hair, like some sort of rough braiding around the base of a lampshade. He might have been anywhere between 35 and 57 years of age, with a blandness and formality of manner and a somewhat shuttered expression that revealed nothing whatsoever of his own personality, his mood or his thoughts. He was courteous, businesslike, and conversational, but not intimate. He inquired about my journey, about the comfort of the Gifford Arms, about Mr. Bentley, and about the London weather. He told me the name of the clergyman who would be officiating at the funeral, the number of properties, some half-dozen, that Mrs. Drabbler had owned in the town and the immediate vicinity. And yet he told me nothing at all, nothing personal, nothing revelatory, nothing very interesting. "I take it she is to be buried in the churchyard?" I asked. Mr. Jerome glanced at me sideways, and I noted that he had very large and slightly protuberant and pale eyes of a colour somewhere between blue and grey, reminded me of gulls' eggs. "That is so, yes." "Is there a family grave?" He was silent for a moment, glancing at me closely again, as if trying to discover whether there was any meaning behind the apparent straightforwardness of the question. Then he said, "No, at least, not here, not in this churchyard."
"Somewhere else?"
"It is no longer in use," he said after some deliberation. "The area is unsuitable."
"I'm afraid I don't understand." But at that moment I saw we'd reached the church, which was approached through a wrought-iron gate between 2 overhanging yew trees, and situated at the end of a particularly long, very straight path. On either side, and away to the right, stood the gravestones, but to the left there were some buildings which I took to be the church hall, and the one nearer to the church, the school, with a bell set high up in the wall, and from within it the sound of children's voices. I was obliged to suspend my inquisitiveness about the Drabbler family and their burial ground, and to assume, like Mr. Jerome, a professionally mournful expression as we walked with measured steps towards the church porch. There, for some 5 minutes that seemed very much longer, we waited quite alone until the funeral car drew up at the gate, and from the interior of the church the parson materialized beside us, and together the three of us watched the drab procession of undertaker's men, bearing the coffin of Mrs. Drabbler, make its slow way towards us. It was indeed a melancholy little service, with so few of us in the cold church, and I shivered as I thought once again how inexpressibly sad it was that the ending of a whole human life, from birth and childhood, through adult maturity to extreme old age, should here be marked by no blood relative or heart's friend, but only by 2 men connected by nothing more than business, one of whom had never so much as set eyes upon the woman during her life, besides those present in an even more bleakly professional capacity. However, towards the end of it, and on hearing some slight rustle behind me, I half-turned, discreetly, and caught a glimpse of another mourner, a woman, who must have slipped into the church after we of the funeral party had taken our places, and who stood several rows behind, and quite alone, very erect and still, and not holding a prayer book. She was dressed in deepest black, in the style of full mourning that had rather gone out of fashion, except, I imagined, in court circles on the most formal of occasions. Indeed, it had clearly been dug out of some old trunk or wardrobe, for its blackness was a little rusty-looking. A bonnet-type hat covered her head and shaded her face, but, although I did not stare, even the swift glance I took of the woman showed me enough to recognise that she was suffering from some terrible wasting disease. For not only was she extremely pale, even more than a contrast with the blackness of her garments could account for, but the skin, and it seemed only the thinnest layer of flesh, was tautly stretched and strained across her bones, so that it gleamed with a curious blue-white sheen, and her eyes seemed sunken back into her head. Her hands, that rested on the pew before her, were in a similar state, as though she'd been a victim of starvation. Though not any medical expert, I had heard of certain conditions which caused such terrible wasting, such ravages of the flesh, and knew that they were generally regarded as incurable. And it seemed poignant that a woman who was perhaps only a short time away from her own death should drag herself to the funeral of another. Nor did she look old. The effect of the illness made her age hard to guess, but she was quite possibly no more than 30. Before I turned back, I vowed to speak to her and see if I could be of any assistance after the funeral was over. But just as we were making ready to move away, following the parson and the coffin out of the church, I heard the slight rustle of clothing once more, and realized that the unknown woman had already slipped quickly away and gone out to the waiting open grave, though to stand some yards back, beside another headstone that was overgrown with moss and upon which she leaned slightly. Her appearance, even in the limpid sunshine and comparative warmth and brightness outdoors, was so pathetically wasted, so pale and gaunt with disease, that it would not have been a kindness to gaze upon her. For there was still some faint trace on her features, some lingering hint of a not inconsiderable former beauty, which must make her feel her present condition all the more keenly, as would the victim of a smallpox, or of some dreadful disfigurement of burning. Well, I thought, there is one who cares after all, and who knows how keenly and surely such warmth and kindness, such courage and unselfish purpose can never go unrewarded and unremarked, if there's any truth at all in the words we've just heard spoken to us in the church. And then I looked away from the woman and back to where the coffin was being lowered into the ground, and I bent my head and prayed with a sudden upsurge of concern for the soul of that lonely old woman, and for a blessing upon our drab circle. When I looked up again, I saw a blackbird on the holly bush a few feet away, and heard him open his mouth to pour out a sparkling fountain of song in the November sunlight. And then it was all over. We were moving away from the graveside, I a step behind Mr. Jerome, as I intended to wait for the sick-looking woman and offer my arm to escort her, but she was nowhere to be seen. While I had been saying my prayers, and the clergyman had been speaking the final words of the committal, and, perhaps not wanting to disturb us, or draw any attention to herself, she must have gone away, just as unobtrusively as she had arrived. Chapter 4 The Funeral of Mrs. Drablow Part 2 At the church gate we stood for a few moments, talking politely, shaking hands, and I had a chance to look around me and to notice that on such a clear, bright day, it was possible to see far beyond the church and the graveyard, to where the open marshes and the water of the estuary gleamed silver, and shone even brighter at the line of the horizon, where the sky above was almost white and faintly shimmering. Then, glancing back on the other side of the church, something else caught my eye. Lined up along the iron railings that surrounded the small asphalt yard of the school were 20 or so children, one to a gap. They presented a row of pale, solemn faces with great round eyes that had watched who knew how much of the mournful proceedings, and their little hands held the railings tight, and they were all of them quite silent, quite motionless. It was an oddly grave and touching sight. They looked so unlike children generally do, animated and carefree. I caught the eye of one and smiled at him gently. He did not smile back. I saw that Mr. Jerome waited for me politely in the lane, and I went quickly out after him. "Tell me, that other woman," I said as I reached his side, "I hope she can find her own way home. She looked so dreadfully unwell. Who was she?" He frowned. "The woman with the wasted face," I urged, "at the back of the church and then in the graveyard a few yards away from us." Mr. Jerome stopped dead. He was staring at me.
"A young woman?"
"Yes, yes, with the skin stretched over her bones. I could scarcely bear to look at her. She was tall. She wore a bonnet type of hat. I suppose to try and conceal as much as she could of her face, poor thing." For a few seconds in that quiet, empty lane in the sunshine, there was such silence as must have fallen again now inside the church, a silence so deep that I heard the pulsation of the blood in the channels of my own ears. Mr. Jerome looked frozen, pale, his throat moving as if he were unable to utter. "Is there anything the matter?" I asked him quickly. You look unwell." At last he managed to shake his head. I almost would say that he shook himself, as though making an extreme effort to pull himself together after suffering a momentous shock, though the colour did not return to his face and the corner of his lip seemed tinged with blue. At last he said in a low voice,
"I did not see a young woman."
"Oh, but surely—" And I looked over my shoulder back to the churchyard, and there she was again. I caught a glimpse of her black dress and the outline of her bonnet. So she'd not left after all, only concealed herself behind one of the bushes or headstones, or else in the shadows of the church, waiting until we should have left, so that she could do what she was doing now, stand at the very edge of the grave in which the body of Mrs. Drablow had just been laid to rest, looking down. I wondered again what connection she would have had with her, what odd story might lie behind her surreptitious visit, and what extremes of sad feeling she was now suffering, alone there. "Look," I said, and pointed. "There she is again. Ought we not to—" I stopped as Mr. Jerome grabbed my wrist and held it in an agonizingly tight grip, and looking at his face was certain that he was about to faint or collapse with some kind of seizure. I began looking wildly about me, in the deserted lane, wondering whatever I might do, where I could go or call out for help. The undertakers had left. Behind me were only a school of little children, and a mortally sick young woman under great emotional and physical strain. Beside me was a man in a state of near collapse. The only person I could conceivably reach was the clergyman, somewhere in the recesses of his church, and if I were to go for him, I would have to leave Mr. Jerome alone. "Mr. Jerome, can you take my arm? I would be obliged if you would loosen your grip a little. If you can just walk a few steps back to the church path. I saw a bench there, a little way inside the gate. You can rest and recover while I go for help. A car."
"No!"
he almost shrieked. "But, my dear man—"
"No! I apologize."
He began to take deep breaths, and a little colour returned by degrees to his face.
"I am so sorry. It was nothing. A passing faintness. It would be best if you would just walk back with me towards my offices in Penn Street, off the square."
He seemed agitated now, anxious to get away from the church and its environs. "If you're sure—"
"Quite sure. Come."
And he began to walk quickly ahead of me, so quickly that I was taken by surprise, and had to run a few steps to catch up with him. It took only a few minutes at that pace to arrive back in the square, where the market was in full cry, and we were at once plunged into the hubbub of vehicles, the shouting of voices of auctioneers and stallholders and buyers, and all the bleating and braying, the honking and crowing and cackling and whinnying of dozens of farm animals. At the sight and sound of it all, I noticed that Mr. Jerome was looking better, and when we reached the porch of the Gifford Arms he seemed almost lively, in a burst of relief. "I gather you're to take me over to Eel Marsh House later," I said, after pressing him to lunch with me and being refused. His face closed up again. He said,
"No, I shall not go there. You can cross any time after 1 o'clock. Keckwick will come for you. He has always been the go-between to that place. I take it you have the key?"
I nodded. I shall make a start on looking out Mrs. Drablow's papers and getting them in some sort of order, but I suppose I shall be obliged to go across again tomorrow, and even another day after that. Perhaps Mr. Kettwick can take me early in the morning, and leave me there for the whole day. I shall have to find my way about the place.
You will be obliged to fit in with the tides. Kettwick will tell you.
On the other hand, I said, if it all looks as if it may take somewhat longer than I anticipate, perhaps I might simply stay there in the house. Would anyone have any objection? It seems ridiculous to expect this man to come to and fro for me.
I think, said Mr. Jerome carefully, that you would find it more comfortable to continue staying here.
Well, they've certainly made me welcome, and the food is first rate. Perhaps you may be right.
I think so.
So long as it causes no one any inconvenience.
You will find Mr. Kettwick perfectly obliging.
Good.
Though not very communicative.
I smiled. Oh, I'm getting used to that. And after shaking hands with Mr. Jerome, I went to have lunch, with 4 dozen or so farmers. It was a convivial and noisy occasion, with everyone sitting at 3 trestle tables, which were covered in long white cloths, and shouting to one another in all directions about market matters, while 6 girls passed in and out, bearing platters of beef and pork, tureens of soup, basins of vegetables, and jugs of gravy, and mugs of ale, 12 at a time on wide trays. Although I did not think I knew a soul in the room, and felt somewhat out of place, especially in my funeral garb among the tweed and corduroy, I nevertheless enjoyed myself greatly, partly, no doubt, because of the contrast between this cheerful situation and the rather unnerving events of earlier in the morning. Much of the talk might have been in a foreign language, for all I understood of the references to weights and prices, yields and breeds. But as I ate the excellent lunch, I was happy to listen all the same, and when my neighbour to the left passed an enormous Cheshire cheese to me, indicating that I should help myself, I asked him about the auction sale, which had taken place in the inn earlier. He grimaced.
"The auction went according to expectations, sir. Do I take it you had an interest in the land yourself?"
No, it was merely that the landlord mentioned it to me yesterday evening. I gather it was quite an important sale.
He disposed of a very large acreage, half the land on Harmaby side of Crethin, and for several miles east as well. There had been 4 farms.
And this land about here is valuable?
Some is, sir. This was. In an area where much is useless, because it's all marsh and salt flat and cannot be drained to any purpose, good farming land's valuable, every inch of it. There are several disappointed men here this morning.
Do I take it that you are one of them?
Me? No. I'm content with what I have, and if I were not, it'd make no odds, for I haven't the money to take on more. Besides, I would have more sense than to pit myself against such as him.
You mean the successful buyer?
I do.
I followed his glance across to the other table. Ah, Mr. Daly. For there, at the far end, I recognised my travelling companion of the previous night, holding up a tankard and surveying the room with a satisfied expression.
You know him?
No, I just met him, briefly. Is he a large landowner here?
He is.
And disliked because of it? My neighbour shrugged his broad shoulders, but did not reply.
Well, I said, if he's buying up half the county, I suppose I may be doing business with him myself before the year's out.
I am a solicitor, looking after the affairs of the late Mrs. Alice Drablow of Eel Marsh House. It is quite possible that her estate will come up for sale in due course. For a moment my companion still said nothing, only buttered a thick slice of bread and laid his chunks of cheese along it carefully. I saw by the clock on the opposite wall that it was 1:30, and I wanted to change my clothes before the arrival of Mr. Kettwick, so that I was about to make my excuses and go when my neighbour spoke.
"I doubt," he said in a measured tone, "whether even Samuel Daly would go so far."
"I don't think I fully understand you. I haven't seen the full extent of Mrs. Drablow's land yet. I gather there is a farm a few miles out of the town?"
"Hoggetts," he said in a dismissive tone. 50 acres and half of it under flood for the best part of the year. Hoggetts is nothing, and it's under tenancy for his lifetime."
"There is also Eel Marsh House and all the land surrounding it. Would that be practicable for farming?"
"No, sir."
"Well, might not Mr. Daly simply want to add a little more to his empire, for the sake of being able to say that he had got it?
You imply that he is that type of man. Maybe he is.
He wiped his mouth on his napkin.
Let me tell you, you won't find anybody, not even Mr. Sam Daly, having any to do with it.
And may I ask why? I spoke rather sharply, for I was growing impatient of these half-hints and dark mutterings made by grown men at the mention of Mrs. Drablow and her property. I'd been right. This was just the sort of place where superstition and tittle-tattle were rife, even allowed to hold sway over common sense. Now, I expected the otherwise stalwart countryman on my left to whisper that maybe he would, and then again maybe he would not, and how he might tell a tale if he chose. But instead of replying to my question at all, he turned right away from me, and engaged his neighbour on the other side in a complicated discussion of crops. And, infuriated by the now familiar mystery and nonsense, I rose abruptly and left the room. 10 minutes later, changed out of my funeral suit into less formal and more comfortable clothes, I was standing on the pavement, awaiting the arrival of the car, driven by a man called Keckwick.
Chapter 5. Across the Causeway. No car appeared. Instead, there drew up outside the Gifford Arms a rather worn and shabby pony and trap. It was not at all out of place in the market square. I had noticed a number of such vehicles that morning, and, assuming that this one belonged to some farmer or stockman, I took no notice, but continued to look around me for a motor. Then I heard my name called. The pony was a small, shaggy-looking creature, wearing blinkers, and the driver, with a large cap pulled down low over his brow and a long, hairy brown coat, looked not unlike it, and blended with the whole equipage. I was delighted at the sight, eager for the ride, and climbed up with alacrity. Keckwick had scarcely given me a glance, and now, merely assuming that I was seated, clucked at the pony and set off, picking his way out of the crowded market square and up the lane that led to the church. As we passed it, I tried to catch a glimpse of the grave of Mrs. Drablow, but it was hidden from view behind some bushes. I remembered the ill-looking, solitary young woman, too, and Mr. Jerome's reaction to my mention of her. But within a few moments I was too caught up in the present and my surroundings to speculate any further upon the funeral and its aftermath, for we'd come out into the open country, and Crithin Gifford lay quite behind us, small and self-contained as it was. Now, all around and above and way beyond there seemed to be sky, sky, and only a thin strip of land. I saw this part of the world as those great landscape painters had seen Holland, or the country around Norwich. Today there were no clouds at all, but I could well imagine how magnificently the huge brooding area of sky would look with grey, scudding rain and storm clouds luring over the estuary. How it would be here in the floods of February time when the marshes turn to iron grey and the sky seeped down into them. And in the high winds of March, when the light rippled, shadow chasing shadow across the ploughed fields. Today all was bright and clear, and there was a thin sun over all, though the light was pale now, the sky having lost the bright blue of the morning to become almost silver. As we drove briskly across the absolutely flat countryside, I saw scarcely a tree, but the hedgerows were dark and twiggy and low, and the earth that had been ploughed was at first a rich mole-brown, in straight furrows, but gradually soil gave way to rough grass, and I began to see dikes and ditches filled with water. And then we were approaching the marshes themselves. They lay silent, still and shining under the November sky, and they seemed to stretch in every direction, as far as I could see, and to merge without a break into the waters of the estuary and the line of the horizon. My head reeled at the sheer and startling beauty, the wide, bare openness of it. The sense of space, the vastness of the sky above and on either side made my heart race. I would have travelled 1,000 miles to see this. I'd never imagined such a place. The only sounds I could hear above the trotting of the pony's hooves, the rumble of the wheels and the creak of the cart, were sudden, harsh, weird cries from birds near and far. We travelled perhaps 3 miles and passed no farm or cottage, no kind of dwelling house at all. All was emptiness. Then the hedgerows petered out, and we seemed to be driving towards the very edge of the world. Ahead the water gleamed like metal, and I began to make out a track, rather like the line left by the wake of a boat, that ran across it. As we drew nearer, I saw that the water was lying only shallowly over the rippling sand on either side of us, and that the line was in fact a narrow track leading directly ahead, as if into the estuary itself.
As we slipped onto it, I realized that this must be the Nine Lives Causeway, this and nothing more, and saw how, when the tide came in, it would quickly be quite submerged and untraceable. At first the pony and then the trap met the sandy path. The smart noise we'd been making ceased, and we went on almost in silence, save for a hissing, silky sort of sound. Here and there were clumps of reeds, bleached bone-pale, and now and again the faintest of winds caused them to rattle dryly. The sun at our backs reflected in the water all around so that everything shone and glistened, like the surface of a mirror, and the sky had taken on a faint pinkish tinge at the edges, and this, in turn, became reflected in the marsh and the water. Then, as it was so bright that it hurt my eyes to go on staring at it, I looked up ahead and saw, as if rising out of the water itself, a tall, gaunt house of grey stone with a slate roof that now gleamed steelily in the light. It stood like some lighthouse or beacon or Martello tower, facing the whole wide expanse of marsh and estuary, the most astonishingly situated house I had ever seen, or could ever conceivably have imagined, isolated, uncompromising, but also, I thought, handsome. As we neared it, I saw the land on which it stood was raised up a little, surrounding it on every side for perhaps 300 or 400 yards of plain salt-bleached grass, and then gravel. This little island extended in a southerly direction across an area of scrub and field, towards what looked like the fragmentary ruins of some old church or chapel. There was a rough scraping as the cart came onto the stones and then pulled up. We had arrived at Eel Marsh House. For a moment or two I simply sat looking about me in amazement, hearing nothing save the faint keening of the winter wind that came across the marsh, and the sudden rawk-rawk of a hidden bird. I felt a strange sensation, an excitement mingled with alarm, I could not altogether tell what. Certainly I felt loneliness, for in spite of the speechless Kekwick and the shaggy brown pony, I felt quite alone outside that gaunt, empty house. But I was not afraid. Of what could I be afraid in this rare and beautiful spot? The wind? The marsh birds crying? Reeds and still water? I got down from the trap and walked around to the man. How long will the causeway remain passable?
Till 5.
So I should scarcely be able to do more than look around, get my bearings in the house, and make a start on the search for the papers before it would be time for him to return and fetch me back again. I did not want to leave here so soon. I was fascinated by it. I wanted Kekwick to be gone, so that I could wander about freely and slowly, take it all in through every one of my senses, and by myself. Listen, I said, making a sudden decision. It'll be quite ridiculous for you to be driving to and fro twice a day. The best thing will be for me to bring my bags and some food and drink, and stay a couple of nights here. That way I shall finish the business a good deal more efficiently, and you will not be troubled. I'll return with you later this afternoon, and then tomorrow perhaps you could bring me back as early as is possible, according to the tides. I waited. I wondered if he was going to deter me, or argue, or try and put me off the enterprise with those old dark hints. He thought for some time. But he must have recognized the firmness of my resolve at last, for he just nodded. Or perhaps you'd prefer to wait here for me now, though I shall be a couple of hours. You know what suits you best. For answer, he simply pulled on the pony's rein and began to turn the trap about. Minutes later, they were receding across the causeway, smaller and smaller figures in the immensity and wideness of marsh and sky, and I turned away and walked around to the front of Eel Marsh House, my left hand touching the shaft of the key that was in my pocket. But I did not go inside. I did not want to yet a while. I wanted to drink in all the silence and the mysterious shimmering beauty, to smell the strange salt smell that was borne faintly on the wind, to listen for the slightest murmur. I was aware of a heightening of every one of my senses, and conscious that this extraordinary place was imprinting itself on my mind and deep in my imagination, too. I thought it most likely that if I were to stay here for any length of time, I should become quite addicted to the solitude and the quietness, and that I should turn birdwatcher too, for there must be many rare birds, waders and divers, wild ducks and geese, especially in spring and autumn. And with the aid of books and good binoculars, I should soon come to identify them by their flight and call. Indeed, as I wandered around the outside of the house, I began to speculate about living here, and to romanticize a little about how it would be for Stella and me, alone in this wild and remote spot. Though the question of what I might actually do to earn our keep, and how we might occupy ourselves from day to day, I conveniently set aside. Then, thinking thus fancifully, I walked away from the house in the direction of the field, and across it towards the ruin. Away to the west, on my right hand, the sun was already beginning to slip down in a great wintry golden-red ball, which shot arrows of fire and blood-red streaks across the water. To the east, sea and sky had darkened slightly to a uniform leaden grey. The wind that came suddenly snaking off the estuary was cold. As I neared the ruins, I could see clearly that they were indeed of some ancient chapel, perhaps monastic in origin, and all broken down and crumbling, with some of the stones and rubble fallen, probably in recent gales, and lying about in the grass. The ground sloped a little down to the estuary shore, and as I passed under one of the old arches, I startled a bird, which rose up and away over my head with loudly beating wings and a harsh croaking cry that echoed all round the old walls, and was taken up by another some distance away. It was an ugly, satanic-looking thing, like some species of sea-vulture, if such a thing existed, and I could not suppress a shudder as its shadow passed over me, and I watched its ungainly flight away towards the sea with relief. Then I saw that the ground at my feet and the fallen stones between were a foul mess of droppings, and guessed that these birds must nest and roost in the walls above. Otherwise I rather liked this lonely spot, and thought how it would be on a warm evening at midsummer, when the breezes blew balmily from off the sea, across the tall grasses, and wild flowers of white and yellow and pink climbed and bloomed among the broken stones. The shadows lengthened gently, and June birds poured out their finest songs with the faint lap and wash of water in the distance. So musing, I emerged into a small burial ground. It was enclosed by the remains of a wall, and I stopped in astonishment at the sight. There were perhaps 50 old gravestones, most of them leaning over or completely fallen, covered in patches of greenish-yellow lichen and moss, scoured pale by the salt wind and stained by years of driven rain. The mounds were grassy and weed-covered, or else they'd disappeared altogether, sunken and slipped down. No names or dates were now decipherable, and the whole place had a decayed and abandoned air. Ahead, where the walls ended in a heap of dust and rubble, lay the grey water of the estuary. As I stood wondering, the last light went from the sun, and the wind rose in a gust and rustled through the grass. Above my head, that unpleasant, snake-necked bird came gliding back towards the ruins, and I saw that its beak was hooked around a fish that writhed and struggled helplessly. I watched the creature alight, and, as I did so, it disturbed some of the stones, which toppled and fell out of sight somewhere. Suddenly conscious of the cold and the extreme bleakness and eeriness of the spot, and of the gathering dusk of the November afternoon, and not wanting my spirits to become so depressed that I might begin to be affected by all sorts of morbid fancies, I was about to leave and walk briskly back to the house, where I intended to switch on a good many lights, and even light a small fire, if it were possible, before beginning the preliminary work on Mrs. Drablow's papers. But as I turned away, I glanced once again round the burial ground, and then I saw again the woman with the wasted face, who had been at Mrs. Drablow's funeral. She was at the far end of the plot, close to one of the few upright headstones, and she wore the same clothing and bonnet, but it seemed to have slipped back, so that I could make out her face a little more clearly. In the greyness of the fading light, it had the sheen and pallor not of flesh so much as of bone itself. Earlier, when I had looked at her, although admittedly it had been scarcely more than a swift glance each time, I had not noticed any particular expression on her ravaged face, but then I had, after all, been entirely taken with a look of extreme illness. Now, however, as I stared at her, stared until my eyes ached in their sockets, stared in surprise and bewilderment at her presence, now I saw that her face did wear an expression. It was one of what I can only describe, and the words seem hopelessly inadequate to express what I saw, as a desperate, yearning malevolence. It was as though she was searching for something she wanted, needed, must have, more than life itself, and which had been taken from her. And towards whoever had taken it, she directed the purest evil and hatred and loathing with all the force that was available to her. Her face in its extreme pallor, her eyes, sunken but unnaturally bright, were burning with the concentration of passionate emotion which was within her and which streamed from her. Whether or not this hatred and malevolence was directed towards me, I had no means of telling. I had no reason at all to suppose that it could possibly have been. But at that moment I was far from able to base my reactions upon reason and logic. For the combination of the peculiar, isolated place and the sudden appearance of the woman and the dreadfulness of her expression began to fill me with fear. Indeed, I had never in my life been so possessed by it. Never known my knees to tremble and my flesh to creep and then to turn cold as stone. Never known my heart to give a great lurch, as if it would almost leap up into my dry mouth and then begin pounding in my chest like a hammer on an anvil. Never known myself gripped and held fast by such dread and horror and apprehension of evil. It was as though I had become paralysed. I could not bear to stay there, for fear, but nor had I any strength left in my body to turn and run away. And I was as certain as I had ever been of anything that at any second I would drop dead on that wretched patch of ground. It was the woman who moved. She slipped behind the gravestone, and, keeping close to the shadow of the wall, went through one of the broken gaps and out of sight. The very second that she had gone, my nerve and the power of speech and movement, my very sense of life itself, came flooding back through me. My head cleared, and all at once I was angry, yes, angry with her for the emotion she had aroused in me, for causing me to experience such fear. And the anger led at once to determination to follow her and to stop her, and then to ask some questions and receive proper replies, to get to the bottom of it all. I ran quickly and lightly over the short stretch of rough grass between the graves towards the gap in the wall, and came out almost on the edge of the estuary. At my feet the grass gave way within a yard or two to sand, then shallow water. All around me the marshes and the flat salt dunes stretched away until they merged with the rising tide. I could see for miles. There was no sign at all of the woman in black, nor any place in which she could have concealed herself. Who she was, or what, and how she had vanished, such questions I did not ask myself. I tried not to think about the matter at all, but with the very last of the energy that I could already feel draining out of me rapidly, I turned and began to run, to flee from the graveyard and the ruins, and to put the woman at as great a distance behind as I could possibly manage. I concentrated everything upon my running, hearing only the thud of my own body on the grass, the escape of my own breath, and I did not look back. By the time I reached the house again, I was in a lather of sweat, from exertion and from the extremes of my emotions, and as I fumbled with the key, my hand shook so that I dropped it twice upon the step before managing at last to open the front door. Once inside, I slammed it shut behind me. The noise of it boomed through the house. But when the last reverberation had faded away, the place seemed to settle back into itself again, and there was a great, seething silence. For a long time I did not move from the dark, wood-panelled hall. I wanted company, and I had none. Lights and warmth, and a strong drink inside me. I needed reassurance. But more than anything else, I needed an explanation. It is remarkable how powerful a force simple curiosity can be. I had never realized that before now. In spite of my intense fear and sense of shock, I was consumed with a desire to find out exactly who it was that I'd seen, and how. I could not rest until I'd settled the business for all that, while out there I'd not dared to stay and make any investigations. I did not believe in ghosts. Or rather, until this day I had not done so. And whatever stories I'd heard of them, I had, like most rational, sensible young men, dismissed as nothing more than stories indeed. That certain people claim to have a stronger-than-normal intuition of such things, and that certain old places were said to be haunted, of course I was aware. But I would have been loath to admit that there could possibly be anything in it, even if presented with any evidence. And I had never had any evidence. It was remarkable, I had always thought, that ghostly apparitions and similar strange occurrences always seemed to be experienced at several removes, by someone who had known someone who had heard of it from someone they knew. But out on the marshes just now, in the peculiar, fading light and desolation of that burial ground, I had seen a woman whose form was quite substantial, and yet, in some essential respect, also, I had no doubt, ghostly. She had a ghostly pallor and a dreadful expression. She wore clothes that were out of keeping with the styles of the present day. She had kept her distance from me, and she had not spoken. Something emanating from her still, silent presence, in each case by a grave, had communicated itself to me so strongly that I had felt indescribable repulsion and fear. And she had appeared and then vanished in a way that surely no real living fleshy human being could possibly manage to do. And yet, she had not looked in any way, as I imagined the traditional ghost was supposed to do, transparent or vaporous. She had been real. She'd been there. I had seen her quite clearly. I was certain I could have gone up to her, addressed her, touched her. I did not believe in ghosts. What other explanation was there? From somewhere in the dark recesses of the house, a clock began to strike, and it brought me out of my reverie. Shaking myself, I deliberately turned my mind from the matter of the woman in the graveyards to the house in which I was now standing. Off the hall ahead led a wide oak staircase, and on one side a passage to what I took to be the kitchen and scullery. There were various other doors, all of them closed. I switched on the light in the hall, but the bulb was very weak, and I thought it best to go through each of the rooms in turn, and let in what daylight was left before beginning any search for papers. After what I'd heard from Mr. Bentley and from other people once I'd arrived about the late Mrs. Drabblow, I'd had all sorts of wild imaginings about the state of her house. I had expected it, perhaps, to be a shrine to the memory of a past time, or to her youth, or to the memory of her husband of so short a time, like the house of poor Miss Havisham, or else to be simply cobwebbed and filthy, with old newspapers, rags and rubbish piled in corners, all the debris of a recluse, together with some half-starved cat or dog. But as I began to wander in and out of morning-room and drawing-room, sitting-room and dining-room and study, I found nothing so dramatic or unpleasant, though it is true that there was that faintly damp, musty, sweet-sour smell everywhere about that will arise in any house that's been shut up for some time, and particularly in one which, surrounded as this was on all sides by marsh and estuary, was bound to be permanently damp. The furniture was old-fashioned, but good, solid, dark, and it had been reasonably well looked after, though many of the rooms had clearly not been much used, or perhaps even entered, for years. Only a small parlour at the far end of a narrow corridor off the hall seemed to have been much lived in. Probably it had been here that Mrs. Drabblow had passed most of her days. In every room were glass-fronted cases full of books, and besides the books there were heavy pictures, dull portraits and oil paintings of old houses. But my heart sank when, after sorting through the bunch of keys Mr. Bentley had given me, I found those which unlocked various desks, bureau and writing-tables, for in all of them were bundles and boxes of papers, letters, receipts, legal documents, notebooks tied with ribbon or string, and yellow with age. It looked as if Mrs. Drabblow had never thrown away a single piece of paper or letter in her life, and clearly the task of sorting through these, even in a preliminary way, was far greater than I anticipated. Most of it might turn out to be quite worthless and redundant, but all of it would have to be examined, nevertheless, before anything that Mr. Bentley would have to deal with, pertaining to the disposal of the estate, could be packed up and sent to London. It was obvious that there would be little point in my making a start now. It was too late, and I was too unnerved by the business in the graveyard. Instead, I simply went about the house, looking in every room, and finding nothing of much interest or elegance. Indeed, it was all curiously impersonal. The furniture, the decoration, the ornaments. Assembled by someone with little individuality or taste. A dull, rather gloomy and rather unwelcoming home. It was remarkable and extraordinary in only one respect, its situation. From every window, and they were tall and wide in each room, there was a view of one aspect or other of the marshes and the estuary and the immensity of the sky. All colour had been drained and blotted out of them now. The sun had set, and the light was poor. There was no movement at all, no undulation of the water, and I could scarcely make out any break between land and water and sky. All was grey. I managed to let up every blind, and to open one or two of the windows. The wind had dropped altogether. There was no sound save the faintest, softest suck of water as the tide crept in. How one old woman had endured day after day, night after night of isolation in this house, let alone for so many years, I could not conceive. I should have gone mad. Indeed, I intended to work every possible minute without a pause to get through the papers and be done. And yet, there was a strange fascination in looking out over the wild, wide marshes, for they had an uncanny beauty even now in the grey twilight. There was nothing whatsoever to see for mile after mile, and yet I could not take my eyes away. But for today I had had enough. Enough of solitude, and no sound save the water and the moaning wind and the melancholy calls of the birds. Enough of monotonous greyness, enough of this gloomy old house. And as it would be at least another hour before Keckwick would return in the pony trap, I decided that I would stir myself and put the place behind me. A good brisk walk would shake me up and put me in good heart and work up my appetite, and if I stepped out well, I would arrive back in Crithengivet in time to save Keckwick from turning out. Even if I did not, I should meet him on the way. The causeway was still visible. The roads back were straight, and I could not possibly lose myself. So thinking, I closed up the windows and drew the blinds again, and left Ealmarsh House to itself in the declining November light. Chapter 6. The Sound of a Pony and Trap. Outside all was quiet, so that all I heard was the sound of my own footsteps as I began to walk briskly across the gravel, and even this sound was softened the moment I struck out over the grass towards the causeway path. Across the sky, a few last gulls went flying home. Once or twice I glanced over my shoulder, half expecting to catch sight of the black figure of the woman following me. But I had almost persuaded myself now that there must have been some slope or dip in the ground upon the other side of that graveyard and beyond it, perhaps a lonely dwelling, tucked down out of sight. For the changes of light in such a place can play all manner of tricks, and after all, I'd not actually gone out there to search for her hiding place. I had only glanced around and seen nothing. Well then, for the time being, I allowed myself to remain forgetful of the extreme reaction of Mr. Jerome to my mentioning the woman that morning. On the causeway path it was still quite dry underfoot, but to my left I saw that the water had begun to seep nearer, quite silent, quite slow. I wondered how deeply the path went under water when the tide was at height. But on a still night such as this, there was plenty of time to cross in safety, though the distance was greater now I was traversing it on foot than it had seemed when we trotted over in Keckwick's pony cart, and the end of the causeway path seemed to be receding into the greyness ahead. I'd never felt quite so alone, nor felt quite so small and insignificant in a vast landscape before, and I fell into a not unpleasant, brooding, philosophical frame of mind, struck by the absolute indifference of water and sky to my presence. Some minutes later, I could not tell how many, I came out of my reverie to realize that I could no longer see very far in front of me, and when I turned around I was startled to find that Ealmarsh House, too, was invisible, not because darkness of evening had fallen, but because of a thick, damp sea mist that had come rolling over the marshes and enveloped everything, myself, the house behind me, the end of the causeway path, and the countryside ahead. It was a mist like a damp, clinging, cobwebby thing, fine yet impenetrable. It smelled and tasted quite different from the yellow, filthy fog of London. That was choking and thick and still. This was salty, light and pale and moving in front of my eyes all the time. I felt confused, teased by it, as though it were made up of millions of lithe fingers that crept over me, hung on me, and then shifted away again. My hair and face and sleeves of my coat were already damp with a veil of moisture. Above all, it was the suddenness of it that had so unnerved and disorientated me. For a short time I walked slowly on, determined to stick to my path until I came out onto the safety of the country road. But it began to dawn upon me that I should as likely as not become very quickly lost once I'd left the straightness of the causeway, and might wander all night in exhaustion. The most obvious and sensible course was to turn and retrace my steps the few hundred yards I had come, and to wait at the house until either the mist cleared, or Keckwick arrived to fetch me, or both. That walk back was a nightmare. I was obliged to go step by slow step, for fear of veering off into the marsh, and then into the rising water. If I looked up or around me, I was at once baffled by the moving, shifting mist, and so on I stumbled, praying to reach the house, which was farther away than I'd imagined. Then, somewhere away in the swirling mist and dark, I heard the sound that lifted my heart, the distant but unmistakable clip-clop of the pony's hooves and the rumble and creak of the trap. So, Keckwick was unperturbed by the mist, quite used to travelling through the lanes and across the causeway in darkness, and I stopped and waited to see a lantern, for surely he must carry one, and half wondered whether to shout and make my presence known in case he suddenly came upon me and ran me down into the ditch. Then I realised that the mist played tricks with sound as well as sight, for not only did the noise of the trap stay further away from me than longer than I might have expected, but also it seemed to come not from directly behind me, straight down the causeway path, but instead to be away to my right, out on the marsh. I tried to work out the direction of the wind, but there was none. I turned around, but then the sound began to recede further away again. Baffled, I stood and waited, straining to listen through the mist. What I heard next chilled and horrified me, even though I could neither understand nor account for it. The noise of the pony trap grew fainter and then stopped abruptly, and away on the marsh was a curious draining, sucking, churning sound which went on, together with the shrill neighing and whinnying of a horse in panic. And then I heard another cry, a shout, a terrified sobbing. It was hard to decipher, but with horror I realised that it came from a child, a young child. I stood absolutely helpless in the mist that clouded me and everything from my sight, almost weeping in an agony of fear and frustration, and I knew that I was hearing, beyond any doubt, appalling last noises of a pony and trap, carrying a child in it as well as whatever adult, presumably Keckwick, was driving, and was now, even now, struggling desperately. It had somehow lost the causeway path and fallen into the marshes and was being dragged under by the quicksand and the pull of the incoming tide. I began to yell until I thought my lungs would burst, and then to run forward, but then stopped, for I could see nothing, and what use would that be? I could not get onto the marsh, and even if I could, there was no chance of my finding the pony trap or of helping its occupants. I would only, in all likelihood, risk being sucked into the marsh myself. The only thing was to get back to Ealmarsh House, to light every light, and somehow try and signal with them from the windows, hoping against all reason that this would be seen like a lightship by someone somewhere in the countryside around. Shuddering at the dreadful thoughts racing through my mind and the pictures I could not help but see of those poor creatures being slowly choked and drowned to death in mud and water, I forgot my own fears and nervous imaginings of a few minutes earlier and concentrated on getting back to the house as quickly and safely as I could. The water was now lapping very close to the edges of the path, though I could only hear it. The mist was still so thick, and darkness had completely fallen, and it was with a gasp of relief that I felt the turf and then the gravel beneath my feet, and fumbled my way blindly to the door of the house. Behind me, out on the marshes, all was still and silent, save for that movement of the water. The pony and trap might never have existed. When I got inside the house again, I managed to reach a chair in that dark hall, and, sitting on it just as my legs buckled beneath me, I put my head down into my hands and gave way to an outburst of helpless sobbing as the full realization of what had just happened overcame me. For how long I sat there, in extremes of despair and fearfulness, I do not know. But after some time I was able to pull myself together sufficiently to get up and go about the house, switching on every light that I could make work and leaving them on, though they were none of them very bright,
and in my heart I knew there was little chance of what was not much more than a glow from a handful of scattered lamps being seen across that misty land, even if there had been any watcher or traveller on hand to glimpse them.